Clubhouse.
Welcome to Decorating the Set from Hollywood to Your Home with your hosts, Beth Kushnick and Caroline Daly.
Welcome to Decorating the Set from Hollywood to Your Home. This is not Caroline. This is producer Mike. Hey, Beth, how are you doing?
Hi, Mike. Welcome to the show. Another week, another great conversation with a legend in the business. This week, we're speaking with my very good friend, Kevin Rupnick, art director and Emmy nominated.
Kevin was fantastic to talk to. I mean, just like you, has been there and done that for a long time. Really, no part of the business, whether it's on the stage or behind the stage, rather, or TV or film, that he hasn't done. And I'm very excited for people to listen to that interview. But before we get to that, I want to talk about a specific project that you both actually happened to work on: Howard Stern's 1997 semi-autobiographical movie, Private Parts. Now, Beth, we have mentioned this from time to time that you've worked on this. It has come up here and there, incidentally, anecdotally, it's come up, but we've never talked about it really in depth, or you and Caroline have never talked about it in depth, and I've always wanted to get into it a bit with you. Now that it's come up again this season, because you worked on it, and Tom Whelan worked on it, and now Kevin has worked on it, we need to discuss it. Namely, how did you get Private Parts? Were you a fan of Howard Stern? Were you listening to him? I need you to spill all of the tea about it, what it was like to get this movie and work on Private Parts.
Well, as a native New Yorker, grew up with the Howard Stern myth, and I heard this job was shooting in New York, and I actually pursued it. It wasn't something that I normally would have done. I was in the Bahamas working on a movie, of all things. And let me just, as an aside, say, you never want to go work on a movie where everybody else in the world is on vacation, because that's one of the most difficult things I've ever had to do. And another little funny aside about that movie is the main character's name was Mary Beth. And I used a lot of locals, like a local electrician and local workers on my crew. And we literally built houses at the ocean. And they were not used to the film business. So when I pulled up in my car the first day of shooting Mary Beth's house, they banned me from going into the house because they thought that I was going to be really upset that the shooting crew had taken it all apart, because they didn't understand how the film business worked.
And so funny.
We had twinkle lights on trees and stuff, and instead of them putting them on the trees, they stapled them down to the floor. So I was really missing my crew in New York, and I heard about Private Parts, and I called the people who were doing it, and I said, I'll fly myself back for an interview. I'll fly in for the weekend. And they said, no, we already have someone. Well, I think it was meant to be my job, because a couple of weeks later, I got called to replace the set decorator.
Wow. And, is there a story there? Is there a story there that you can even tell?
There's not really a story that I can tell.
Off-mic story is what we call it. Okay.
Sure. Off-mic for you, Mike, anytime. The one thing I do remember was they were pretty far ahead in the prep, but not shooting yet. So I didn't want to come to the stage to interview for that job, because I would be seen by crew, and it's just not something I wanted to have public. And I'd never been in that situation
before. Because you would be replacing someone.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
And then you didn't want bad blood or anything like that.
So I met the director, Betty Thomas, and the producers and the production designer in a park by Silver Cup Studios. And we called it my deep throat interview. you know.
What park was by Silver Cup Studios? And did you get a crack pipe or something there?
It's not there anymore. Yeah, it was during the day, so it was safe. But it was a highly unusual circumstance. I've never been in that circumstance before. Then when they gave me the job, they asked me to work with the person that they were firing and have that person on my team, which was a rough go.
Oh, my goodness.
But nonetheless, the first thing I did was go into the storage space where the set decoration for the movie had been acquired. And there were a lot of smiley faces. Smiley face pillows, smiley face fabric, smiley face things. And, you know, I sort of always subscribe to the more subtle form of set decoration. So I do remember saying, okay, put all the smiley faces away because we're never going to use them. And we didn't use them. And I actually had the unbelievable honor and privilege of becoming Chuck Rosen's set decorator. He was the production designer. And I think he and Stephen Hendrickson, production designer, have taught me more than any two people, my greatest mentors. We had an incredible experience on the job because Howard was doing his show and would be, you know, have to do his show and then come to work after. We had an apartment kind of built for him, a space at Silver Cup Studios, and we shot something that's called French Hours. It's the only job since then that I have ever done, ever worked French Hours. But French Hours are when you don't break officially for a meal. You know, they sort of serve food all day and you can take your own break and then go back to the set. And I think it's like, you know, a cool Parisian thing where that doesn't happen in the United States, except...
Well, the union rules, I can't believe, even allow that, that you don't have mandated breaks and hours that are regulated. I would imagine that's the reason why it doesn't get done more often, probably, right?
I don't know how they worked it out, but they worked it out for French Hours.
They were afraid to come to Silver Cup in Long Island City and enforce the rules. That was what it was.
Well, that was an amazing job because any time we were going to go shoot on location, it just never seemed to work out. I worked every single weekend. I remember we were going on location to shoot a scene in Private Parts in a tent, a camping scene. And they came to me and said, is there any way that we could build that on set? And that was sort of the go-to, to come and say on Wednesday, could we have it by the end of the week? Even though it looks like, really, when I watch that movie nowadays, it looks so period, but there were so many things to take into consideration. Someone asked me about this recently. We were talking about linen color, and there were so many scenes that started in a bed, whether it was, you know, in Howard's youth or through the years. And a lot of really definitive decisions were made, what the sheet color was going to be, and a lot of specifics that Howard gave us pictures of his growing up, of his home, of radio stations. There was so much technical stuff to consider, creating all those radio stations. We had really wonderful experts. It was an amazing job, and he was magnificent, and he was gracious and grateful and really good to the crew, and I think one of the highlights of my career.
That's fantastic. I mean, from a rocky start to such a good experience once you were in it.
Yes, and Kevin was one of the art directors.
I was going to say, so that's not where you met Kevin. You know him before then.
Years before then, right. For years. In the theater, we met.
You talk about that a little bit on the interview, but let's talk about this week's guest, Kevin Rupnik. As you mentioned earlier, Kevin is an art director. He worked as an art director on Private Parts. You guys met in the theater. We get into this a bit, but let's talk about your job as it intersects with the art director. You have such an interesting interesting job because it is so visible. It's one of those jobs where, what does the set decorator do? And just look at a scene and be like, that's the set decorator right there. But you answer to people and you interact with people and you have to run things by certain people. How much does the art director determine whether or not you're going to have a good or bad experience on a production?
Oh, very much so. There's the creative end of my job, and I think that's what everyone is drawn to, and everyone thinks it's so glamorous or, it's so great to be shopping for furniture and things. And then there's like a real nuts and bolts aspect to my job, and it's about scheduling and budgeting again and changes and actor availability and details of organization that the only way that you can learn that is by experience. And I have really honed my craft in that aspect because I think it's the most important. I've never been over budget on a job. I mean, I may have gotten a budget that was too low to do a job and said, this is what it's got to be. And I'm usually right on the number. And I value that much more than picking out a sofa, because it's the reality. It's the real part of making it all work. And the art director is my hand-in-hand collaborator in that nuts and bolts making it happen aspect. Whereas my work with the production designer is more about executing the vision, more about character development and things that are important visually. But really the art director facilitates what has to get done on a daily basis. And what time do I have to accomplish my job? And it's a job filled with a lot of responsibility. And Kevin and I have such a long working relationship, and we have very similar feelings about the stuff that he does, the scheduling, the budget being just as important as the look of the show.
I love these last few episodes that we've done because we've really gotten a good look, I think, into you via the people you have chosen to work with over and over again. And there's a theme running amongst all of them on top of, having a good sense of humor, which seems to come up in all the episodes.
Yeah.
And in the conversations and your visual communication with them, even if maybe you don't agree on how something will look, but the passion behind it and the reasoning behind it is there. They're not just being willy-nilly with how they choose it. But for an art director, what about Kevin, separate from you, what do you think about him makes him a good art director? Because I think if we had asked him this directly, I think he would have self-deprecated. So before we listen to the interview, what about him specifically, separate from your own experience from him, do you think makes him a good art director?
Well, he does talk about it. The one thing that he has really learned from his parents and growing up and how to communicate, he's a great communicator. He's very sincere. And, when he checks in with every department and sort of says, okay, what are your problems today? Let me help you. It's not a false statement. I mean, he's truly working with a big picture. And I think that's what he does the best. He's taken his years of varied experience and he can see the big picture. Nowadays, I find that people who are not so experienced, I don't want to sound like in a situation I'm a naysayer or pointing out the problems, but it takes a certain level of experience and a person to be able to say, okay, this is not such a good idea because this is going to end up being a problem. And the film business is all about problem solving. So I think he cuts to the chase and gets to the problem before it becomes, oh my God, we got a problem.
People don't understand the importance in all jobs, and not maybe all jobs, but many jobs, the idea of being able to be proactive and nip something in the bud, but also having that big picture But, you know, there's an aspect, he talks about in here how he starts his day and, you know, he goes and says good morning to everyone. And he, you know, specifically goes and like says good morning to the carpenters, I think is what he says. And, you know, someone who does that and makes that a regular habit is someone that people are going to feel like they can trust, that they can work with, that that is taking them into account when they're thinking about how a day should go, having that big picture. He's keeping all of it. So not only is he actually doing it, he is making everyone around him feel that way, which is just as important. People want to be seen when they're trying to do a job.
It's really a collaborative art. You know, for me, it's the same thing that I do with interacting with my lead man and my crew and my teamsters. And, you know, if one person is off on a certain day, the ripple effect can really be huge. You know, I depend so much on my vendors and my crew, and it's something that he also understands, you know, how the nuts and bolts of the business work.
Guys, I am excited for one, so let's get to it. Kevin, thank you so much for joining us today. How are you doing?
I'm well. Thank you very much. Thanks for asking me.
We love having Beth's friends on here. We're always waiting for that one person to spill the good story about her. But before we get to Beth, though, we want to start with your beginning, because that's always a good place to start. We know, like Beth, you got your start in theater, but talk to us about those early days. What was your path that led to working as a scenic designer on stage? Was this college for you? Was this a lifelong, this is what you knew you wanted to always do? Give us your start.
Sure. Well, you know, I was in high school in Cleveland, Ohio. Actually, Brooklyn, Ohio, if you can believe it. I was an actor and I was a set designer, both at the same time. I designed Guys and Dolls and I was Sky Masterson. I designed Oliver and I was Fagin. But my mom and dad were very pragmatic and didn't have high school degrees and said, okay, decide what you want to be when you grow up. And I said, okay. And so I thought acting is a terrible, terrible way to make a living. But set design, I kind of got it. Like, you show your work and somebody says, okay, that's really good work and I can hire you. So that's what I pursued. And then my mom and dad from Brooklyn, Ohio said, okay, what school should you go to for set design? And I did my research and I said, Carnegie Mellon in Pittsburgh seemed like the right place for me to go. Now, I was so naive, you know, I mean, it was a really expensive school, like it was a private college. But you know what? My mom and dad were amazing and they said, okay, that's where you'll go. And in retrospect, you know, I mean, they were incredibly generous and made it work. And I made it work. You know, I had scholarships and stuff like that. So that's where I went. Then at the beginning of my senior year at Carnegie Mellon, my professors came to me and said, now you should go to the Yale School of Drama.
Just like that.
And wow. Just like that. Which they had been to. And I said, what? I've just been studying with you for 3+ years, and now you're telling me I need to go somewhere else for 3 years? And they said, yeah. Anyway, long story short, or slightly long story short, I applied, got in, and went. And I was at Yale for 3 years after my time at CMU.
And wasn't that sort of the heyday when a lot of people who ended up in New York post-master's program were there with you?
For sure. Carnegie Mellon and then Yale were the places to go. I have a friend who was a year ahead of me at Yale, and we always joke that, you know, we got dressed for the prom and we moved to New York and the prom got canceled. But that's a whole other story.
It's so funny. I saw Yale on your resume and yeah, got your master's there. And then I realized that it's the David Geffen Yale School of Drama. And I just that doesn't work in my head. It just doesn't the fully
yeah, no
like
kidding.
New name. It doesn't. It feels like a disconnect there.
I agree.
What's the leap then from theater to television to movies? And how do you go from one to the other? Because I imagine it's the same work, but also kind of very different work. But maybe it's not.
It's very different. Frankly, it's about following the money, to be completely honest.
Sure, we got to pay for our art.
Yeah, yeah. And you know what? I mean, I moved to New York from Yale. I worked a lot. I was so lucky. My friends from Carnegie and Yale introduced me to directors, and I got work automatically when I moved to New York. I almost never, ever assisted another designer. I was doing my own thing. But you know what? The money was limiting. And year after year after year after year, I thought, you know what? Well, here's what happened. I started working at ABC in daytime, news and sports, and then soaps. That was real money. And that sort of transitioned me into filmed entertainment from live event entertainment.
Now, for those that don't know, one of the things we like to do on the show is educate the listeners. And there are a lot of savvy people who listen, but some people don't know what all of the titles in a, if you're watching the credits, mean. What is the art director? What do they do on a TV or movie production? What are you responsible for in that role?
Yeah, fair enough. Good question. So here's what happens. There is a producer or several producers, as Beth knows, like, yes, a dozen producers. There is a director. There is a production designer who collaborates with the director on the look and feel of the show, of the big picture of what's going on with that film or that series. And then there's the art director, who I like always joke. Whenever I get an art director job, I take two post-its and I write, and one post-it rock, R-O-C-K, and the other post-it says hard place. And I post one on the left side and one on the right side, because the art director not only is answering to the production designer and the director, but he or she is also answering to the producer or the unit production manager, who is looking at the budget in a big way. So, you know, and then the art director also runs the budget, runs the crew.
Runs the schedule. So
runs the schedule.
So that can turn into a nightmare for all the other departments if you don't have a savvy art director.
So when Beth complains that set decorators don't get the set until right before the shoot is going to happen and has to work overnight in order to make that happen, is that schedule being set by the art director or by a producer who has told the art director, like, this is what's available to you?
Both. But I think that the art director has a responsibility to the set decorator and her crew or his crew to provide them with enough time to do their job in a thorough way.
That working relationship is pivotal. You know, I'm collaborating so much with the production designer in terms of look, but the actual how the hell is this going to get done is between me and the art director.
Yeah, I mean, I'm working on a project right now which is extraordinarily complicated because there are no locations. It's one set after the other for 4 weeks. I mean, I've been working on a spreadsheet now for 3 weeks to make sure that the set decorator has the time in his schedule that he needs to do the right job.
Let's talk about the collaboration and the interaction, because it's a recurring theme in Beth's work. And so anytime we have one of these other department heads on or people on, it's something I personally love to hear about. What is your level of interaction with the other departments? What is it like working with, say, a set decorator? How much is your way or the highway versus your listening and being collaborative and trusting the experts in those fields to know what they're doing? It's a balancing act, I would imagine, but tell us a little bit about it.
Yeah, I know it's all about the latter. It's all about communication, collaboration, listening. At the end of the day, I don't know what Beth needs. I mean, I sort of do from my experience. I kind of know that she's going to need 5 days on a set or 7 days or 2 days. You know, I mean, I've been around enough to kind of be aware of what her needs are or what her department's needs are. But, you know, at the end of the day, she needs to be involved. I mean, I need her to participate and feel, you know, take ownership of the schedule.
I don't have any problem with that.
Right. Why should you?
Well, Beth, you talk to us about what makes a good art director from your point of view. Is it someone who's giving you cover and allowing you to work, or someone who's completely hands off and you don't want to hear from them? Like, or, you know, where's the mix for you?
It's in true collaboration. I mean, part of why Kevin and I work together so well on every kind of varied project, from TV, episodic TV, the films, to commercials, is because we sort of have the same approach, which is that rock in a hard place and the reality of it. And then between us, we have many years of having a sense of humor about it because it's all insane. But when that position is filled with someone that I haven't worked with before, someone who's not good at their job, the ripple effect, how the nightmare sort of flows down in my department as being the last line of defense before you're shooting, it can be critical. I'd say it's also a position, interestingly enough, where because it's so tied up with money and schedule, I've seen a lot of art directors get fired. They sort of really have to handle the crises that come up from every department. You know, you figure a grip and electric need the set to light it, and construction and scenic need time. And, you know, so they're really put in this difficult position of a balancing act among so many different departments.
Now, Kevin, how fair is that? Is the art director more of a sacrificial lamb, or is it really the buck stops with you if you're being held out to dry for these things that may get someone fired? Is that fair to place at the art director's feet as the crossroads for where the rubber meets the road?
Well, here's what. Yes and no. I mean, I think that, you know, you need to nurture relationships with people. The set decorator, the lead man, which is his or her right-hand person, carpenters, electrics. I mean, there are a lot of people skills required if you choose to own them. And I believe firmly that you should own them. When I go in the morning, I go around and say hello to all the carpenters. I am focused on building a relationship with the set decorator on the project. I am focused on building a relationship with his or her lead man. This is simple skills. It's an interesting world because you are on a job one project at a time. And I've actually been in the corporate world as an events creative director, and in that world, you build relationships with the people in the office. And sometimes in show business, there's not that taste for building relationships. You've got a job, you want to get a job, you want to get through the job, you want to leave the job, you know?
Yep.
So I think that it's important to build relationships. I mean, Beth and I have known each other, as she mentioned, for a long time. And we crack each other up. I mean, we laugh a lot. And it's super important.
And I think also we've worked on jobs with LA production designers who've come to New York, and either Kevin has known them or I've known them before, and we bring each other on the job. And, you know, they're really taken with our way of communicating and collaborating, because we never let them see you sweat. We both believe in that, and we talk our problems away from the person that we're working for, and we don't bring added extra drama to the situation, but we do laugh a lot. And I think of all the people that I've had on our podcast, I actually think I go back furthest with Kevin. As I said, we've worked on so many different jobs. It's just very innate now. It's like second nature.
is that the secret sauce for you, Kevin? Is it communication, whether it's visual communication or just open dialogue between your people and you, that makes it work?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, I forget who told me this, but, you know, somebody said managing by walking around. And I know art directors who sit at their desk and do paperwork 24/7. And God bless them. That's how it works for them. But for me, I understand the importance of the paperwork and the scheduling and that kind of stuff. But, you know, for me, it's all about building relationships and having a dialogue with everyone down there, out there, up there, who is, including producers, by the way.
It's sometimes in art direction and set decoration, since we're advancing the company and we're never with the shooting crew, you can be on a whole job and sort of never really interact with the shooters that much and never feel like a part of the shooting crew. And I think it now takes more effort to do that, you know, because a lot of set decorators can just sit at their desk and scroll the internet to find things. And we've talked about how that's really problem making when a chair you're looking for comes and it is better suited to a dollhouse. But it takes an effort to really engage with all these different departments and show that you're interested in more than just your department. And I think especially post-COVID, when we were all separated and doing our meetings and stuff on Zoom, now, you know, it really takes an effort and it's worth doing for both the art director and set decorator.
Kevin, I actually wanted to pivot to your career because, again, I was looking over all the things you've done in the last, you know, 30 plus years. It spans theater and operas. You've done dramatic television. You've done soap operas. You've done movies. You've also done industrial design as well, I know. That feels very varied, but talk a bit about how you've merged those different experiences and interests into a career. Do they borrow on one or another? Are you using tools from your time in theater on movie shoots and vice versa? You know, explain how you've combined all of this wide swath of experience into this singular career.
Yeah, it's funny you bring that up. I mean, I think that, you know, it was once said of Lady Di that she was smart but not strategic. And I remember that I was not strategic. I took whatever came my way. And lucky me, like, cool things came my way. You know, I was working in daytime drama. I got hired to do a primetime pilot. I moved out to L.A. While I was in Los Angeles, I got hired to do opera in Europe and in New York. And then I got hired to do a big live event at Euro Disney, or Paris Disney as they call it now, which involved my time for over a year. Then I got a call from New York from the producer of All My Children saying, I need to make a change here on this show. Do you want to come design All My Children? I said, yeah, moved back to New York. I could bore you with all the nuttiness of, you know, I mean, I have colleagues who made a decision to do this, that, or the other thing and stuck with it. And frankly, maybe they're more successful than I am because they focused on something and kept with it. You know, I've got colleagues who are production designers on TV shows now, and I maybe could have done that, but I didn't pursue it. Anyway, I've been lucky, honestly. I've done all sorts of crazy stuff and met people like Beth. And so the long answer is I haven't really, like, focused on building a career. I've just done stuff.
Just accumulating experiences wherever the world takes you, it sounds like.
Yeah.
Is it wanderlust? Do you think is it you have this set of skills and also a desire to not really be tied down in one place for too long, and it just works?
Yeah, I think it's more the former than the latter. I think that if I sat down and thought about it, maybe I would be more focused. But, you know, I mean, come on. They offer you Buffalo Bill's Wild West show at Euro Disney Paris.
Yeah.
Scenery and costumes.
Like, who's saying no to that?
Who's saying no to that? Exactly. Like, and it's a year's worth of work. And P.S., the production manager used to run the Paris Opera, and they're flying you first class from Los Angeles to Paris on Air France.
Hard to turn down. Hard to turn down. I mean, I barely can swing a hammer, so I wouldn't be hired for this job. But but I see why you would want to go do it, though, for sure. Beth, I know you have thoughts about this, too. We've talked about your career and the many different things you've done. What's the benefit to you to keeping things varied?
Well, in my early years, I, too, ended up sort of lucky enough to just get one offer after another. And I started in the theater and when I met Kevin, I was working as a director's assistant, and he was the production designer on a show called Love, L-U-V, an American musical. And it had a really interesting set with a bridge. And from under the bridge in the theater, the way that I first encountered Kevin was I heard someone singing below the stage, Love is a Battlefield. And that's our kind of watchword that we've kept through both of our careers. But I've always subscribed to this idea of I say yes to everything. Someone calls me and says, can you do a Zoom background for a lawyer? At the same time that someone calls me for a commercial and someone calls me for a TV show and someone calls me as a private client. And there can be a day that I have seven potential projects and 24 hours later, two of them still exist. And then a week later, four of them may exist. So, you know, I really, especially now, the way the industry has changed, because, you know, you used to commit to 22 episodes a season, and it didn't feel like being such a freelancer. It felt like the work was always there. I'm of the theory that you just say, yes, I'm available. And it seems to always end up working out. You know, one goes away and one comes your way, and then, you know, the one that went away shows up a year later, and it's more about being available and building relationships and being positive. And that's sort of how I've always kept my numbers up. It's sort of like online dating. You know, you have to be available.
If you cast enough lines out right. there, something will bite.
Exactly.
How much of it, though, also, though, works out to become transferable skills? There's value in doing the Wild Bill show in Euro Disney, not just because you get to be in Paris for a year and doing that work, but will there be something there that's going to come in handy 15 years later working on a CBS procedural?
Absolutely. I think the way we both are trained before computers, before cell phones, very classically, both through our education and our experience, I think we take that maybe not as savvy as someone younger taking it into the future, but we have the same skills that we can transfer, whether I'm doing an interior design project or a feature film, and they're hardcore classic skills. They've gotten me through everything. And I may tweak them depending on what project I'm doing, but they give me the confidence to know that I can say yes to anything.
How about you, Kevin? Are you using accumulated skills maybe from 15 years ago in Paris for a job you may be doing now?
Actually, less than Paris. You know, I've been doing a lot of work in the live event industry, and like for companies that you wouldn't know about, like Jack Morton or Freeman, which are corporate, it's corporate events, it's live events, it's trade shows, it's big corporate meetings, like lots of people, lots of money. And that's been hugely instructive for me. Sorry, quote unquote, managing up. I mean, knowing that I can't tell a producer no, ever, no matter what he or she asks me. because of the work I did at Jack Martin, because of my work with clients, I always say yes. And I didn't know that when I was doing set design and working in regional theater or even in television. I didn't know that until I got the experience working in live events with clients.
You know, each job sort of pushes you to your limit in a different way. You know, I just completing working on a low budget film, and it's definitely challenged me and my usual skills because I don't have a budget and time and crew to depend on. But I think each one of those jobs that you get, it makes you feel like I really do know how to do this, and I've just may have to be applying my skills differently. But I think it's a certain mindset that stays the same.
Kevin, Beth mentioned before when she was talking about, you know, earning your classical skill sets. She mentioned before computers, which made me think about the idea of both of you been in the industry for so long and well before the rise of computers and the modern technology that people assume goes on now. So from your point of view, how has the business changed the most since you've been doing this, do you think?
Well, first of all, I'll tell you something kind of ironic, which is, a guy I hired to draft a set I designed for, I think Seattle Rep. I can't remember exactly where it was. I think it was Seattle Rep. He won an Emmy this spring for something he art directed. And I thought, well, there you go. My former assistant is winning Emmy Awards. So there, you know, it just kind of cracked me up. But it's called hand drafting, which is you use a pencil and you use a slide ruler, whatever, you use a drafting table, I had a professor at Yale named Ming Cho Lee who was astounding. And his call to action was start strong, finish strong. That would be a line on a page on a piece of drafting paper where you actually started the line super super strong, and then you drew the line, and then you ended the line super strong, if you can imagine what that means. That's a whole business that isn't used anymore.
That's such a good reference.
Yeah, when I think about how hard I try to learn Ming's drafting technique, and now it's useless. It's useless now. Oh, yeah, great.
I mean, it's not useless because you have a certain perspective based on that training that even though college students aren't getting anymore, and in a way it's interesting, this week I did a talk for Syracuse University students with a production designer that I'm working with for their screenplay class. And, you know, the questions that they ask are different. Their approach is different. Everything is different, but it's equal with how the business has evolved. But I think I feel like I can always answer a question based on my early training. You know, it just has given me real success. And even though things have changed, you know, you figure out a new way of doing it. It surprises me that things are getting done the way they do now, you know, with people not leaving the office and not having the same kind of relationships that we used to have. Because, you know, our business was a very outside business, you know, very active, always going to vendors and picking things out and seeing other people. And it's become much more of a solitary industry sort of between me and my computer, you know, but I wouldn't have traded the training that I got for anything.
Well, it feels like it would be incomplete because even if you've moved to something completely online, there's a tactile in-person nature to it that maybe you have missed out on if you've never had that experience.
Exactly.
You know, you can, the way something looks on a screen doesn't necessarily look the way it feels or looks or hits you in person.
No, you're right. And here's the other thing I'll mention, which is thank God our business is not ageist. And I find, you know, for instance, my construction coordinator on my current job. He's done a lot. He's not a young guy, and he's been all over the place like me. And we connect, and it's great, and it's useful. You know, I mean, he's done live events, for instance, I found out this week. You know, he knows, he can see in me a connection with my experience, and I can see in him that connection. And also, you know, the current set decorator I'm working with, you know, has, like me, tried to get out of the business a number of times. I mean, he's pursued other things. And one of the first things I said to him when I saw him after, you know, several months, years of not seeing him, is, well, you and I have tried to get out of the business and here we are back in it. And we laughed about it. And this is a good conversation for me to have because I'm, you know, I tend to be a little disrespectful of the work I do because it's hard work and it's long hours and we're all pushing to do the right thing and make it great. And, you know, it's difficult, frankly.
What's your favorite part of the job? What keeps you fueled?
You know what? My dad was a tool and die maker. I don't know if you know what that is, but he was a factory guy. And my dad, he never went to high school, okay? But my dad had a relationship with the guys he worked with on the floor. I think about him often because he taught me to respect the working guy and respect the crew and respect the carpenters and the grips. And, you know, I mean, I think about him all the time in that world that he lived in and toiled in. And that's, for me, the most rewarding part is working with the crew and letting them know that they're appreciated, they're respected. Good morning. Thanks for the week. That stuff is meaningful to me.
What are some of the things that have inspired you as a designer? Any particular style or books?
You know what, Beth? I'm pretty open to everything. I mean, I guess I've seen stuff that I was not impressed by, but, you know, like right now I'm working on a project that the director wrote the screenplay for Chicago. Now, that was one hell of a movie.
It sure was. Right? I worked on it a little bit. It was shot in Canada, and I shopped for it here in New York.
Aha. So Bill, you know what? He's a nice man, and I really respect him. He didn't direct Chicago. Robbie Marshall did, but who I went to school with, by the way. So I have a connection with that film in two ways now. But, you know, and it's, you know, Jennifer Lopez. But, you know, I gotta say, you know, what Bill Condon did on Chicago was pretty impressive.
It was. Of all of the many failed musical to movie adaptations, I think Chicago stands still. I actually just rewatched it about a couple months ago. Still holds up as a great adaptation of a classic show.
Yeah, well, it's right up there with Cabaret.
For sure.
Yeah. Yeah, so I'm excited about this. I don't know what to think about it. I'm terrible with reading scripts and choosing a verdict. Like, this is going to be a hit, this is going to be a flop. I'm terrible at it. So I don't know what's going to happen here. But, you know, Bill is Bill, and he's working away. And, you know, we've got a choreographer who's been working for weeks on this. And, you know, it could be great.
What is the project? Can you tell us the project?
Yeah, it's a film version of the Broadway show Kiss of a Spider Woman.
Wow. Okay.
Which was done as a film without any of the music years ago. With Raul Julia and Bill Hurt, I think.
Yes.
William Hurt.
Yes. Incredible cast.
But this is a full-on musical version with all the songs restored.
Wow. With J-Lo attached. It was interesting because you said there's design that maybe you don't like. You're open to everything, but there's maybe design that you don't like. Which leads me to ask, though, are you drawn to projects maybe are more of a period or that are more of a contemporary design? Like, all things being equal and you had your choice, would you go do a genre piece, a period piece, a contemporary piece?
Well, to be frank, as an art director on a film, I would avoid a period movie like in a minute because it's really hard work. I did a period film a couple years ago, a Baz Luhrmann series for Netflix called The Get Down. And it took place in the 60s or 70s. And every awning, every street sign, every traffic light, like all the stuff you don't care about, like had to be changed out. And yep,
getting the air conditioners out of the window and changing everything.
Yeah.
So that all falls under production design and art direction, even the way the lines are painted on the sidewalk, on the streets, all those things get taken into consideration. Period cars. Those are sort of the not so pretty technical things that become such a big part of our jobs, along with picking out the right period sofa.
Yeah, I mean, we shot in the Bronx, you know, and every single storefront was wrong. You know, every single awning was wrong. Every single street sign was wrong. And it wasn't very creative, frankly.
The thing is, people become so savvy nowadays, and they will freeze frame to look at the awning. You know, I know because I do it. I do it as part of my podcasting job for TV shows that we recap. You know, and if it's not right, people will like go and you know
they reach out to me. I get those emails,
or you know they'll become internet stormborners. You know, on like Reddit and you know vilifying that kind of stuff. I would imagine it's a thankful task unless you do it great and then people celebrate you because that authenticity, we hear about that word so much now, about the authenticity is so accurate. Well, sometimes it's hard to, you know, recreate 1960 Brooklyn or, you know, wherever it may be.
The parameters could be as simple as a location that you're shooting at. The homeowner says, no way, no how, you know, but the rest of the block will give you the permission. Things get taken care of with CGI, but it doesn't always work.
Beth and I did a commercial a year and a half ago out in Long Island. It was actually more like a music video, but it was supposed to be Christmas. It was with Jimmy Fallon, and it was supposed to be Christmas, and it was October, and it was 55 degrees inside and outside of this house, those poor people. So we turned their front lawn into a winter wonderland. Fake snow, ice, water, like the, you know, snowmen, reindeer. I mean, big house, big house. But we had some laughs.
Beth, was this the commercial with the chair and a half?
This was the chair and a half.
The chair and a half.
Kevin was in the car with me when we realized we needed a chair and a half instead of just a chair. And I found one on our ride home and we picked it up the next morning and it was a chair and a half for Jimmy Fallon and his girls.
Of all the funny things we've talked about in the years of doing this show, I did not know that the chair and a half was going to resurface so many years later.
See,
so
that's that?
The chair and a half is legendary.
That's pretty funny. Kevin, is there a project that you've worked on that stands out to you when you close your eyes and you're trying to sleep and you're awakened at night with cold sweat that because it was either extremely hard or difficult to pull off and that you did and that maybe stands as like a mark of, hey, I was able to do that?
That's funny you ask. I did.
So a Spider Woman coming out in.
No. That's falling off a log. I know how to do that. What I didn't know how to do was an interior design for a very wealthy guy who worked for Dow Jones, his apartment on the Upper West Side. And what started out as a decorating job was pretty simple. His ex-wife had done the apartment. He wanted a change. He was kind of angry at her. But what happened was it evolved into a total gut renovation. New kitchen, new bathroom, new closets, new doors. And I was completely ill-equipped to make that happen. And I didn't know it. And I was also, P.S., working full-time at Jack Morton, an agency that does events. So I had a full-time job. And I was trying to make this guy's two-bedroom apartment into a one-bedroom apartment. It was a gut renovation. And I was in way over my head. I realized it too late. And I tried to get some help, but I couldn't find anybody who would take over the job at that late date.
Why don't you call me?
Did I call you?
I don't think so. I would have said yes.
No, Beth, this was such a nightmare. And the guy was a drunk, and he would call me at 11 o'clock or 12 o'clock at night screaming at me. And it was so horrible. And the thing that was horrible about it is I knew I was screwing up. I knew I wasn't delivering because I was in way over my head. It got done. Somehow I found a contractor. They were furious with me. I found painters. They were furious with me. You know, I decorated it. And you know, I did a good job. I mean, it was really beautiful. But it was one of the worst experiences of my life. So there.
That definitely is the kind of thing that will wake you up in the middle of the night in the cold sweats.
Oh, my God. I have scars.
Well, on that note, Kevin, thank you so much for joining us. If people want to follow you on the internet or social media, where can they find you?
Sure. It's www.kevinrupnick.us.
That's fantastic. Kevin, you have been a dream. We love getting this look behind the curtain. If you can, we'd love to have you back on and keep, you know, especially after your next project comes out. And we'll be sure to keep an eye out for that. But thank you so much for your time today. We really appreciate it.
You know what? It's been a pleasure. And it's always a pleasure spending time with Beth.
Thank you. Love is
a
battlefield.
She cracks me up. She's one of the funniest women on the planet.
We love to hear. We didn't get the good Beth tea that we were hoping for today, but we got some nice words, and that's always, that matters.
Listen,
even
there
more.
Are some real go-tos, advice, and everything coming out on this one.
Yeah, I love it. I love it. Listeners, make sure you head to Kevin's website, and thanks so much for listening, and we'll check you guys out next week. Kevin, thanks again.
You're welcome. Thank you very much.
I think that's going to do it for this episode. Thank you all for listening. Don't forget, you should head to Kevin's website. It's kevin.rupnick.us. You could check out his work. You could pull up his resume. You can see everything he's been doing since the early 80s. And while you're doing that and while you're listening, don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe to Decorating the Set from Hollywood to Your Home at Apple Podcasts, Spotify Podcasts, or wherever you listen to podcasts. Please leave us a 5-star review. It helps a lot in the promotion of show so other people can find the show. And if you know, say something nice about us, we're going to read it on the air. So 5 stars, people. Thanks for listening.
Decorating the Set from Hollywood to Your Home is an original Pod Clubhouse production, recorded, edited, and produced at Pod Clubhouse Studios. For more information, please visit us online at podclubhouse.com. Don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe to Decorating the Set at Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to podcasts. Thank you for listening.